I'm an actor. I play many parts.
Space. The final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast, Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Welcome to episode 61 of Gimme That Star Trek, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Siskoid, and this is the start of a new season of the show. Welcome back, one and all. A few weeks ago, I went to see a play called Buoy. That's buoy for my English-speaking listeners. A rare science fiction experience in that medium, which included many references, both subtle and overt, to Star Trek. Which is what interests us here. And I immediately wanted to talk about it with the people involved, about not just Buoy, but the whole process of taking inspiration from that franchise to create one's own art. So, welcome my three guests. First of all, the writer of Buoy. We have Céleste Godin.
Hello!
And also at our table, two of the actors who, like Céleste, are former improv peeps of mine, I should mention, Ludger Beaulieu.
Hello.
And Philippe-André Colette.
Bonsoir.
So, thank you for coming, first of all. And let me start by simply saying that I really enjoyed the show. And I felt like it was speaking my language. So, it was made for me, possibly.
You're welcome.
But what was the general response? Like, I'm the nerd. Of course I get it.
I mean, people are nice to our face. So okay. we only know those responses. Whatever critiques people have, cranky in corners, we'll never hear. But I think it was overall positive. I think we reached an audience that doesn't necessarily go to the theater. So that's always kind of neat on that end. And the one I got the most was like, I don't know what to say about it yet. You kind of broke my brain. I'm going to go think about it. I'm like, yeah. Mm. My mom's boyfriend said, ugh. The stuff you write hurts my head. And I was like, yeah, it sure does. So I got a lot of existential feedback.
Yeah, it was a very existential
always.
Show.
Yeah. Different people have different reactions as well. So you say it spoke your language. A lot of people went to Flo, who had the Trekkiest monologue in the show. And they were saying, I didn't understand much, but I liked it. I liked your part, but... It's as if people hooked on the Trekkie language and could not see past the filter, even though she was not really talking about Star Trek in her. Right. So I think the Trekkies in the audience, we had a few, by the way.
You can hear them.
Yeah. You can hear them in the audience.
Because you hear like a singular like...
Yeah. At the like... very oddly specific references, you can always hear a little giggle here and there.
Yeah.
So we had a few Trekkies that enjoyed it. And a lot of people that are absolutely not Trekkies that enjoyed different parts and made sure to tell us that they did not understand the Trek parts a lot of the times.
Yeah.
Okay, so it could have been a barrier for some people.
For that part.
Yeah,
of the
maybe.
Show, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe that specific part. But the feedback I got was there's a lot of people that hadn't come to see a theater play in a while and then decided to come. Because of the subject matter and also because of the people putting it on. But even my mom, who's 80, she came to see the show. She's not a Trekkie. She knows nothing about science fiction movies. And she thought it was very human and enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it goes beyond...
As is Star
it's
Trek.
The yes, exactly. It goes beyond the technical aspect of it. And it's really about humans and... cosmology, their place in the world, etc.
Yeah, and there's different monologues that have different, different languages to them. So there's one monologue that's very specifically written in Trek Talk, but Philippe André does one where he's bouncing through a multiverse looking for a crush.
Yeah.
And really come embodying different states of being, which has, you don't need any background in science fiction to know what a panic feels like. And Ludger does one that's just like a letter to aliens on behalf of humanity, which I think is also fairly relatable.
I thought it was very touching.
Yeah. Personally, yours
being scared of being
you say like relatable. Yeah. You say relatable. A lot of people told me it was very relatable.
Yeah.
Word more than once.
Yeah.
As feedback.
Yeah. From but I think with monologues, you can get that. You know, you're hearing the person's inner thoughts. We should mention maybe like describe the premise of the show. Here's how I described it. I said, humanity decides to update the information sent out into space on Voyager, the probe. And maybe tell the truth this time as a warning to aliens as much as an outreached hand.
Absolutely.
Oh, very good.
Are you writers?
I'm a bit of a writer. So you get different monologues, but each character has a monologue, but you also have the transitions that have...
the other pieces of media, if the listeners are familiar with the Voyager, which I suspect they are, if you're familiar with the original Voyager project, it didn't have a bunch of monologues in it because it wasn't a theater show. It was a record.
Right.
But it had songs from humanity and pictures, which we did in video form this time because we don't need to put it on a vinyl. It's not recorded on an 8-track tape. We got more space. But it had these kind of like portraits of humanity done through pictures of the Earth or sounds of the Earth, which is a really cool one. They're all available on Spotify now. If anybody's interested, and you can see even the pictures they put to try to explain to an alien who presumably can read your instructions. Which days I know you're presuming things about what kind of creature you're encountering, but I guess you have no choice. It's 1977. Mm-hmm. You've got 2 months to slap this together and put it on a disc. You do what you can. But they, you know, they start with like, there's a tiny piece of plutonium on it, and then they can measure the degradation of it because it's stable. And then they're like, okay, well, if you look at that, and then here's our math. 1, 1, 2, 2, 2. And then they show like arithmetic, and then it gets more complex. And it's based on that little piece of plutonium. You can see how long it's been since it's been sent from Earth, and then you can calculate how far away Earth is. Anyways, in those images, they also have a silhouette of a man and woman, which originally was supposed to be just 2 nude pictures of human beings to show what creatures we are, but it got censored by NASA at the time because it was too edgy, so it ended up being silhouettes. So the premise of this one is like, that's not very complete. And they chose to not put the atomic bomb or war because they didn't want it to seem aggressive, but that's an incomplete portrait of humanity. If somebody that reads the news or has eyes or ears or just anything, that's part of who we are too. So I kind of looked at it as like a Tinder profile. If somebody saw that original capsule, we look so peaceful and chill, and then you show up and you land in Russia and you're like, ah! So we want to kind of update more parts of what humanity is because it's all those things at once.
Yeah, there was a lot of contrasting images.
Yeah.
It's like Earth is nice, it's awful, it's silly, it's
full of garbage and treasures, and sometimes they're both the same thing, and then
and crabs and trees drawing on paper in the wind, and
the crabs is crazy.
The crabs is crazy.
The crabs is crazy because there's been there's a name for things that turn into crabs, and crabs have evolved 6 separate times on the planet so far. So there's a theory that the end goal of like the end product of any evolution is crabs.
To become a crustacean.
Specifically crabs, though.
Oh. We're going to turn into crabs.
I'm allergic to crustaceans.
Oh, no!
Me too. Until I become one, and then I'll just have to deal with it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they'll be our overlords. It's not. We're not going to eat them.
But there's something interesting about what you said between NASA wanting to be not too violent in their images, because we had this talk during the production where we were talking about a mass shooting in a school.
Yeah.
We didn't see the original version, but our
sound designer
included the audio of it's a school shooting, but and he toned it down to just include a reporter talking about it. And we were trying to ride the line between honesty and being too violent because...
With our audience.
With our audience, but also in a philosophical way with the aliens, because the it's a fine line between truth and aggression. And if this, I'm talking, we didn't really go that deep during the production, but in a philosophical way, if you go too intense with the truth, it can seem like a threat.
Sure.
So you could have possible retaliation from the aliens that find your... So, yeah, that was the extreme of our discussion. But, yeah, we wanted to know where is the line between truth and being unbearable to watch and needing to have content warnings. we didn't really want to go there, so it was a fine line to explore.
Sometimes there was like a thing in the video or in the in the sound that would be like, oh, that's you know, that's a gut punch.
It used to be a bigger gut punch. We toned it back down a little bit because it didn't fit with the rest of the vibe.
Even just juxtaposing two different images back to back can convey some kind of meaning too, and that's part of the discussion AJ was referring to. The premise of having two images one after another, is that a statement you're doing? So the videographer actually changed in the placement of a certain image so it wouldn't convey a certain meaning.
In the Star Trek universe, Voyager becomes V'ger, comes back to Earth. So that wasn't in the play, but I knew it was kind of a riff on that as well. Voyager returns, but combined with an alien craft. And almost destroys the Earth. So until people have sex with it.
In which episode or which?
It's in the movie. It's the motion picture.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they have sex with it. And so.
Of course. Of course.
Which, like.
And it's not even Kirk. So there is that element. But I'm wondering, how did this all come to you? That, like, to do essentially a science fiction show.
Well, it was a little bit of the intention right from the get-go. Our director and company director, Makalvi Chagall, and I are both Trekkies, or Trekkers, depending on.
Depending on what show you're watching at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the level of depth that we have is not the same as you.
Oh, well.
But I do look up stuff on Memory Alpha, you know.
Okay.
So, and that kind of like our love for the Star Trek franchise has kind of like kept us connected through hard times. So like even sometimes in production, I want to drown him. Sometimes I'm sure he wants to drown me too. And then a new episode of Picard comes out and we're like, hey, you see that episode? Because none of our other friends want to talk about it with us. So we have this kind of like connection that's based around our love of the same pieces of media. And so when we started to kind of like explore doing another show together, because we did the first one called Overlap about 5 years ago now, and we're like, we want to be about space. And he was like really into astrophysics and Einstein. Oh, yeah. And I was like, kind of lukewarm about that, but like, we'll explore it. I was like, Star Trek, gonna cram it in a show. And we explored different stuff for like 3 years.
Oh yeah.
A lot of exploration.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you guys were also involved in this?
Oh yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's something that's particular about Satellite Théâtre, is that the creation process is exploratory. So we're like, okay, we kind of want to do spacey stuff, and Mahamay is kind of into like physics right now. So let's try that. And we tried a bunch of stuff with quantum physics, and we learned that explaining stuff does not make very good theater. And if you don't explain the basics of it, then you can't get to the part of quantum physics that's poetic. You kind of need a little bit, and kind of getting through all the steps of how something works is really painful to watch. So we know that we don't want to do that too. And if you miss one of the steps, you feel like an idiot. Mm. And I don't want the audience to feel like an idiot. So we tried some of that stuff, and it ended up showing up in one of the monologues. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time figuring out how we'd float. So we explored different dynamics of floating.
The floating days. My legs still hurt.
Like, you know, okay, if we hide their lower body, can we do this? What if we have one person that's doing the legs and the other one's doing this? Because we know we can't rig them off the ceiling in the theater we're going to work. So we kind of explored all that stuff together. And little pieces of stuff that we tried and improvised. And you guys as the actors wrote some stuff that we played with for which felt to me an interminably long couple weeks. But it was COVID, and we weren't allowed to breathe on each other. So, you know, and kind of pieces of that all stayed. And then we got to a point where I just decided to kind of write what I wanted to write. And what's awesome about Mahali is because he also loves Star Trek, I was like, I put a couple references in this, and I feel like that's not the right amount. So either it's less, or what if we just went way too far into it? And that's the direction we ended up going. We're still going to tweak it for the next stuff, by the way. But we're like, no, let's go all in. And it's kind of like, in French you have the expression, se payer la traite, treat yourself. So we're like, let's go for it. And some people will not relate to it, and that's fine.
Because you sort of start off with that. That's the first monologue.
Pretty much.
Second?
It is,
first,
yeah. Second. Yeah, the first one is that.
The mission commander.
Yeah, which plays on the Jimmy Carter letter that's in the original Voyager capsule, which is a really beautiful letter that he wrote. He's like, humbly, us on little humanity, we're kind of dumb, we're kind of broken, we're trying to do better. Please, you know, like, we're reaching out to you with all the humility we have, which is, his letter is really beautiful. So the first monologue plays on that, but like, what if it was written right now and nobody spell checked it? So it's like wonky. And then it goes right into Trek fairly early on.
Florence has I assume she's not herself a Trekker.
No.
No, she isn't. So she kind of comes into this universe.
And has to learn that language.
Through needing mm-hmm. to pull it off. Mm-hmm. As if she intrinsically knows the difference between a Ferengi and Cardassian. Which to her, she's just like, why is it Cardassians? You know, like, yeah. you know, if you don't mm-hmm. come from that. I think it's a new word.
But even if she would have been a big Trekkie, I still think she had the hardest monologue to convey because of the jargon and all that. Yeah, technobabble. Yeah.
Do you guys have any real contact with Star Trek to begin with?
Oh, yeah. I've watched a lot of Star Trek in my life. I remember when the first movie... You're my age,
so we got to...
Yeah, when it was the first on TV movie, The Search for Spock, when that came up. Mm. Or no, the first one, which was... the motion picture one. I remember I was too young when it came out and I thought it was long and boring, yep. but I never stopped watching Star Trek. I remember the end. The end is spectacular though, with the new character that comes in all shaved head and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I remember young, it was, for me, Star Trek was always there on TV. It was always like that song, you hear it once and it's completely printed forever in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so I always kept on watching, and I remember, like, even when The Next Generation came out, I started watching it a lot. I don't find it ages that well. The acting is kind of cheesy, and sometimes writing. But I really enjoyed the new Strange New Worlds. That was fun.
Yeah.
Because this is actually, I said, oh, I saw the show, and I immediately wanted to talk about it. No. I actually wanted to talk about it way before, because... Lujay, we saw each other at a Christmas party.
Before Christmas, yeah.
And you mentioned, we asked, well, what are you working on? How's the show? And you started talking about it a little bit. And of course, you brought up the Star Trek connection. Yeah. And that Celeste made you guys watch certain episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that's what we did with your tax dollars, with Marc-André as well. Because Marc-André and I would have these reference points, and the rest of the team didn't necessarily have the same ones. So, and sometimes you get kind of stuck when you're doing an experimental process where you're just like, meh. Or like everybody's tired.
Yeah.
From doing it. Or everybody has COVID and we're tired. You know, like we've kind of been through all these things. So we're like, well, today we're just going to watch some Star Trek. And then my family and I would fight about which episode because we can't watch them all. And if you pick the wrong one, then you're making it worse.
No, your whole team's going to be like,
your whole team's going to be like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. Right. Yeah. So we're just like, ugh.
Because when Yuji told me this, I said, which ones? And he doesn't know the episode's names, but of course...
I don't know the numbers, no, but I can tell you which
ones.
We watched a TNG episode. We saw the one with Data's daughters, the first one we watched.
Right, The Offspring.
Yeah.
So exactly what I was doing. Yuji was going, and then there was
a bit of that.
And I was going, so I know you watched Darmok.
We watched Darmok because there was a lot of references about that. Because there's a line about it that Florence is like, what the fuck am I saying? What do you mean? What do you mean, dumbasses, our arms wide open? And I was like, okay, well, and that's a really good one. I love the premise of that one to like, okay, what if you can't communicate? Because it kind of relates to the bigger part of the show, right? We're trying to communicate with aliens, but like, what if they don't have eyes? What if they don't have ears? Are they going to smell your record and guess what you said? You know, like, just kind of these kind of gaps in communication. And I found that one has a really satisfying payoff. Like, and we did The Offspring because it has some of that, like, it starts and you're just like, this is so, for somebody that's never seen it, this guy's an android and he's trying to make a baby. People are like, okay. And then, what's her name? What's the daughter's name?
Lal.
So she's like, she's in a weird wig and she's like, And then all of a sudden it starts to get bad and everybody's crying because it flips on you because, she does look kind of weird. Yeah, he's weird. The whole premise is bizarro. And yet there's something really still authentic about the part where she picks her own gender. You're like, oh, that ages differently than it would have probably read when it first came out. And then you're like, oh. And then you can see that he just became a father and now he's losing a child. And you're going to, spoiler alert for listeners.
My listeners have seen The
Offspring. Yeah, you guys have written The Offspring. So, and then everybody's like, oh. And you're like, see, now I can flip. Some episodes are so silly looking that you will pee your pants laughing. Mm-hmm. Season 1 TNG. And then it'll flip on you and you're like, oh my god, to season 2 TNG where you're like, who's this new doctor? And tell us the one with the trial on it, whether Data or not is Star Trek's property. So
Measure of a Man. If you were waiting for me to play that game.
I was, yeah. Okay. So and then you have those things too. And then you kind of experience them both and you're like, oh. Because you can't transfer the nostalgia of what it felt to watch it when you were a kid to somebody who didn't. Like, right. Nostalgia is
or not, seeing it hundreds of times until you know the script.
Until you know the script and you know the errors and you know which actor was also in the background of another episode and blah, 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 who wrote it and all this stuff.
But when you choose the right episodes to show to people that know next to nothing, I think you chose well because there were really theatrical in their moral dilemmas and their philosophy, and so it spoke to us to see that and inspired us, and some of the concepts, like you said, age very differently. And you we didn't see the episode, but you told us something about Data's name at some point. Someone calls him Data, and they say, what's the difference?
That isn't a measure of a man, I think.
Yeah.
There's a new doctor that comes in.
Uh-huh.
Pulaski always calls him Data.
Yeah.
He calls him Data, and he goes, no, it's Data. And she goes, what's the difference? And he says, one of them's my name, and one of them's not.
Yeah. That ages differently, and it speaks to some of the concepts, not directly in the show, but that we as a team are, you know, sensible to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, to us that have seen... Me, I've seen barely nothing. I've seen what Celeste showed us. I've seen the first Star Trek stuff I've seen is the more recent movies.
Right.
That was my first contact with Star Trek.
J.J. movies?
Yeah, those. And then I went back and watched a few things.
Yeah, I mean, some of it I can't watch. Don't do it. It's okay. Yeah. Okay, I have the TOS is really tough for me because it works at that 60s pace.
Mm.
I'm just like, okay, yeah. But with the other one that we watched that I think is a real winner was this first episode of Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, that was good.
That was really good because it's a new one. So you don't have to have nostalgia. You can't have nostalgia for it because it came out last year, right? So already the barrier of what feelings you have is already lowered. It's more accessible. But that first episode is so damn good.
That was a Prime Directive episode.
So you get a lot of the philosophy with it. Mm-hmm. They're kind of funny. So kind of like retro, but also current. Like, as far as the pacing goes, you know, because, hopping into the original series and you're just like, okay, get ready for some real slow, real low-budget stuff, which is okay if you're in that mood, but if you're used to watching modern TV, it feels like it's glacial pace. So Strange New World is a really good, entry into the world and the philosophy and the Prime Directive and, and just kind of the larger philosophy, the speech he makes when he's like, this is what we used to be, and he's like... No, you gotta be better. We did better. You can do better. Whatever he says.
I think that's the crux of that speech that Florence has to give is the promise of science fiction versus the reality.
Yeah, the promise of Star Trek specifically because it is an optimistic point of view because Gene Roddenberry used to write speeches for the police. So he used to see how gross humanity was in L.A. at the time and I guess smoked some weed, I don't know, and then wanted to see something more optimistic. There's a lot more dystopian science fiction out there, which I don't personally relate to because I read the news. I have enough dystopia in my life. Yeah, that difference between what Star Trek told us would be the space exploration and Jeff Bezos going into space is such a big difference.
Well, we have 40 years until First Contact as of yesterday at the time of recording. So that way, there's a third world war that has to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
400 million dead. I mean, I'm just going by the dialogue.
I mean, floods.
And then after that, we find Utopia.
Great. Well, you talk about how Star Trek is the promise of something, you know, more peaceful or new or whatever. But I feel like I'm going to speak with Michelle about or Sisko about our generation. Like, I feel that's... Science fiction was the promise that things can get better. And now that we're a bit jaded, Star Trek is still the promise of, oh, well, we can still cling on to that.
Yeah. Star Trek's a little darker. Star Trek did get darker as a result.
Yeah. But one of the things I find with the new series, Strange New Worlds, it's new, so there's no nostalgia, but you have that kind of nostalgia for the characters you've known your whole life. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to see a young Uhura, for example.
Yeah.
But then the structure of the show, I find the episodicalness of it. I'm thinking especially of the one where it's like story time. It's like the whole fable of the king and the all play characters. And to me, that's like a wink to the original
series. And then it's been 50 minutes and they wrap it up, put away the fairy costume never again.
Yeah. So that's like really good TV, I find, you know, like for escapism.
I find that satisfying too, that like it wraps up at the end of the episode. Discovery's not like that at all. It's like really season long arches of stories. I'm like, what happened with the red suit person 7 episodes ago? I don't know.
I'm watching like, that one right now.
I only have 50 minutes. I've been watching too much TikTok. Okay. 50 minutes of attention is all I can do.
I think I'm on episode 6 or 7 of Discovery.
Yeah.
But even then, like, one of the main concepts is about traveling, like, basically teleporting through spores and fungi.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, that's so freaking cool as an idea. And that's, I mean, is it really possible scientifically? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. It's so great for science fiction. For
it's so great. What a great idea, you know?
Which like, is also kind of the
mushrooms are
fun.
Allowing us to fly.
So they never really get into super detail. I mean, you can have the technical manuals of how the stuff works, but you can tell it's a little bit gobbledygook.
Yeah.
Because, there's a thing and it might explode, and then we did some stuff and it didn't explode. And which stuff they did almost never matters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's somewhat consistent fun, not always. It doesn't really matter. It's a warp drive. It does stuff.
So you watched some Star Trek, okay? And you're still watching some Star Trek. Did you actually modify your performances based on some of the things that you were forced to view? I say forced.
I mean, they were paid to view it.
We were paid.
I mean, they're kind of forced.
But paid.
Forced but paid,
All right. If I could get paid to watch Star Trek, I'd be a rich man, actually.
We also did one that was just like a presentation tour. Like, okay, here's a presentation of all the stuff in Florence's monologue, because we don't have time to watch an episode that touches on all of it, and if we pick the wrong Ferengi episode, you're never going to watch Star Trek again. Yeah. So we're like, okay, here's a Ferengi. This is a this is a Trill. And we just had like the pictures of the different crews from the different shows. We're like, this is this guy. This is this guy. And I don't know if that made any sense, but boy, oh boy, did Makane and I have fun getting paid to do that for an hour.
At least we had images. At least the crew had mental images of what Florence was talking about.
And even like what she talks about, it covers several different French like series, right? So we're like, this is a different crew. This is from that ship. This is from this. This is the boss of this ship. She's a girl. And then pointing out some of the like, some of the behind the scenes stuff. We're like, yeah, this is cool. She used to be security officer. Now you're going to see, we're going to watch her die in a few minutes. But here's why Denise Crosby left Star Trek. You know, like some of the behind the scenes stuff too, right?
My question stands.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe more you, Philippe, André. On my part, not really. Because as the show went on, it became more and more about the human situation at large. So it got less and less science techie and more about humans being alone in a relationship and then humans being alone in the universe. So I didn't really modify my performance after seeing the Star Trek because I think I found my thing fairly early, really, really early, like early November last year. So that was kind of at the same time of the Star Trek. Anyways, and I worked on that instead of, but people that, I know Flo had a complete, she had the real Trekkie monologue. She changed a lot of things after she understood all the, you know, saying, naming this race of aliens versus this race of aliens means this human concept versus this human concept. Mm-hmm. She understood that after. Things completely changed. She understood more, so we understood more of her script as well. But I don't know about you, Philippe Henry.
Because yours, like, you were the finishing move in the play. And Flo was sort of the opener in terms of that content. And Philippe Henry, you're the centerpiece. You had like a big chunk.
Pièce de résistance.
The big chunk in the middle, but yours was less Star Trek and more. It was the multiversal stuff. So, and with the, I don't know what came first or last or what, but the poster, the buoy poster, is it a donut? Is it just a buoy? By whatever, you know, it looks like a cosmic donut.
Mm-hmm.
And so to us, it seemed like, okay, this is the chunk where that may be inspired by Everything Everywhere All at Once because of the bagel.
I didn't see that movie.
That's what I was wondering.
People kept bringing it up to me because I had a pretty intense googly eye phase a few years ago, which I mentioned in my last play. And people kept being like, this movie is perfect for you. And I was like, okay, I'm not done writing this show. And if I'm not, if I'm writing on something, I work really hard on like being authentic to my own voice. So I didn't watch that movie until December this year after the show was written, semi on purpose. Because like, there's googly eyes and there's a multiverse. I'm like, nope, it's too close. And just like, I tried to read Bill Bryson's A Brief History of Everything. And the first page is like, the cells are made out of your unique event. And I was like, it's too close to what I'm writing. I don't want to read. Actually, if I write that, it'll just be a shitty version of what Bill wrote. Mm. So I didn't see that movie until after that monologue was written. And then I was like, oh, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, okay. The donut bagel, yep, that looks the same. You're right. Poster, we had our poster before I saw it. I don't know if Fred saw it. I don't know. I didn't put googly eyes on you, but I would. Right now I'm into rhinestones. It's the same thing. But and then not just the idea of a multiverse, but like looking for someone you care about through that multiverse. Yeah. And not being about like... You know,
it's a quest.
It's a quest through, and the multiverse is like a way of seeing all these possibilities, but I've always talked that way about crushes that don't work out. It must be in the next planet.
Right. I think the other part of it is that, you know, if it was like the Marvel Comics multiverse that's in the movies.
Which I'm not very familiar with that one because it's too loud for my ears, the Marvel movies.
Okay. in that case, it's different versions of ourselves.
Absolutely.
But similar to Everything Everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's parallels like between yours the show got and nuts. That movie.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask me if like Star Trek was kind of an influence, no, because Star Trek is very clean. Like the teleporting technology is very, like no one has to prepare. Like you're just like, okay, teleport me. And like you can be in whatever position and you're being teleported and that's fine. And
it almost always works.
And it almost always works. And even like when they shoot with their tasers or whatever, or phasers, it's like...
But even the dialogue is very precise and
Star Trek. Yeah, so it's very clean and crisp and my piece was not that at all. I mean, he starts off, he's half cut already. It's at a wedding. He's manipulating this machine, which in what Celeste wrote was like, it's a kind of a multiversary traveling machine, but it looked like a theremin. But really, it was just something I'd have in my hand, assuming I could take it out of the pocket or whatever. But now I had nothing. So it was all kind of...
Yeah. You were traveling through mime.
It's not at all in this a Star Trek aesthetic, on the contrary. And then I remember I was having a CBC interview on the radio, and the host says, do you do it like... what's Cumberbatch? What character does he play in the multiverse?
Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange. And I'm like, yeah, kind of, a little bit more, because he's more like the way, physically, how I was going about it, but that was not at all my... I find Star Trek it's conceptual for me more than, there's no grittiness to it. And I thought, my piece was gritty.
Oh, extremely gritty.
See, it's not glamour, it's very, even at the end, and his whole quest is... It's not like a noble quest. It's very selfish. Yeah. It's very selfish.
Yeah. Yes, but his realization at the end, his epiphany, is more noble.
It's very beautiful. What he says at the end is very strikingly beautiful. And he's the kind of character that needs to go through all that crap to figure it out, you know?
The whole show was kind of gritty, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because there's nothing clean about it, per se. One of the things I loved is, I love puppetry. And by which I mean, I don't mean puppets, but I mean when you move things around. Yeah. I've done it a lot in improv shows as well. Just, what I call in French, I call it the mimja. Where you're technically invisible, but you're manipulating objects to make things happen. Yeah. So you're a ninja, but a mime mimja. And so there's a lot of mimjaing in this.
There is.
When the rocket takes off, you see the probe flying through, and it's always manipulated by people. And you're also manipulating each other with your weightlessness tricks.
Yeah.
So all of that, it's physical. It's, you know, it feels very tangible.
That physical stuff is kind of the aesthetic or the kind of expertise of our director, Macron.
Yeah, definitely.
He went to a Jacques Lecoq school of sort of mime, but not mime as in like reproducing specific motions, like I'm opening a window, I'm opening a door. It's more like miming in terms of like motion dynamics.
Yeah.
And you know who else went to that same mime school? Gates McFadden went to that same mime school.
Really?
She did.
Because I know she was a puppeteer. She worked with the Muppets.
She went to that same kind of forum, and she's still involved in theater. But it kind of comes from that movement dynamic thing. And he did another show in 2017 or 16 called Grum, which also involved onstage kind of like fourth wall breaking puppeteering stuff, and which I really loved about that show. Like, you've got these kind of onstage people in suits that are playing picture frame that keeps going crooked. They go, eh. So that's kind of his aesthetic, and I think what works the best with my writing and his directing is when we kind of get my words and that kind of motion stuff. And we worked a lot of that there's literally puppeteering in this show. One of the floating effects is done with a set of fake legs on sticks. And it works pretty well, and at least half of our audience does not know how.
Okay, there were fake legs in that. See?
Part of the fake legs. Yes. See? No, it's crazy. Yes. Like, even people that are like theater directors, they're like, fake legs? We're like, well, you can... Okay, great. We're glad it worked. Because we tested all the other ways of floating, and the fake legs works the best. Yeah. But yeah, you've got Flo crouched behind Kat, who's got four legs. And she's... Every time she bends over, Flo is a really good puppet manipulator, puppeteer. And has the legs kick up just as she's bending over. But they're fake legs on stick. And if you
pay... But just enough. She never milks it.
She never
just
milks
enough
it.
Just enough so you don't see the illusion.
We don't milk it for the gag. Yeah. It's really an illusion. Yeah. And if you do it wrong, it looks like her back's broken. So we know exactly where the line is. But there's a one point where she does a 360, where she's like basically does like a handstand and keeps going as if she was floating. Flo stands up. You can see her holding the sticks. And Philippe Henry has to get up because you have to pass them to another person to complete the rotation.
With the sticks, but people still don't get
it. People still don't get it. No, there's something about that that works so well that you know something's going on because there's just not... Cats on it, but you physically see them passing the sticks with the feet, and yet
it doesn't works. Register.
It works, and, you know, it works even on a ninja, on a manja. So there's something about that that really works, and we tried to do it where you didn't see the puppeteering.
Exactly where I was going.
And we tried to do it, and we never were because our objects weren't perfect enough, and I love you both, but you're not professional puppeteers. So we could do it really well, but not seamlessly, where you couldn't. So we had to kind of flip it the other way, where you accept that you can see them, and that's part of the magic too. So you know, Lujie gets hit in the face by a cat a couple times.
People love the cat was great. Trying to be hidden was we kept it like that for a long time.
We tried, and then we're like, "There's going to be a magic hula hoop of light, and you guys will be invisible."
No. It's not a ninja if you don't see the ninja.
There you go.
So it's about accepting. Like, there is such a thing as, like, you watch Star Trek today, especially today, where all the effects are seamless. It's photoreal. But if you go back in time to older television, sometimes you just have to accept that this is just representational.
Absolutely.
We understand, like, the effects aren't good enough to make you believe that's real. Mm-hmm. But we used to accept that more as viewers of things.
Absolutely.
That this is just a representation of, I understand that this is what's happening, even though... Obviously, on the screen, that's not...
Yeah.
So, in theater, there's not a whole lot of places to actually hide.
No. Yeah. And to me, the success of that, it's about the crew. We've been working for, like, three and a half years. Like, on and off, obviously, because of the circumstances, but still. And it was the entire same team, except for one actor who couldn't make the run.
Yeah, we had
run,
one actor that did all the exploration with us, and then we brought in somebody else to do the show part.
So... The fact that the crew is always there, like even when the show starts, we enter as a crew, as a space crew in our astronaut suits and helmets. But then quickly we become like humans. But the crew is always there to support the monologue. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes the convention for the public and they accept that. But as you would accept that this is the crew for this show in a spaceship and this is... They're going to tell us a story. We accept that as a spectator of Star Trek as well. So I think that's why the pieces worked really well in this show, is because it's that notion of a troupe, a theater troupe, or a crew. And the crew was there. Really.
And I respect the challenge that seemed to us and the audience. It's like any one of you was on stage, you know, doing something pretty much the whole time. And you're either supporting someone doing all the tricks and the puppeteering and the behind the scenes sort of thing until you get to do a monologue that is, it's you alone doing a large piece of text. And then you can't bounce off anyone really at that point. So I felt like this is part of your style. I didn't see overlap, but people have talked to me about it.
Stylistically, there are some parallels. I was a single child growing
up. Is that what?
I'm a bit of a loner. I don't know. I would rather write monologues my whole life than write a bad dialogue. So,
but and you come from you had a, like a poetry background before that.
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
It kind of all fits. I didn't see overlap, but in this case,
well, you have your chances coming back.
Is it coming back? So, but in this case, I felt like, well, it makes sense because it's about aloneness. It's about
People have interpreted it that way. Also, I really wanted to write like a fun like space crew, like okay, when we tried, we sucked, it was rough. Because I don't write fiction. Like when I was a kid, I wouldn't imagine stories with characters and development and all this stuff. So my imagination doesn't really work in a
fiction. Portrait.
Yeah, it doesn't really. I don't really build fiction in my head.
Right, it's portrait rather than narrative.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And then so like we're writing a whole crew talking. I'm like, that's five people talking at once. How the fuck do you do that? And then they tried to improv stuff, but almost nobody on the team is a science fiction person.
We don't master the subject, so we can't really improv.
So then trying
on
to
it.
Like, you know, I'm like, you guys just pretend you're a space crew and make it up. And they're like, ugh. So we improv some pretty bad. There was a couple moments that was the one of the computer worked. Pretty good.
Yeah, that was funny.
That was kind
of
funny.
One of these improvs we did was we were a space cleanup crew.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
Coming after a genocide.
Yeah. Space going genocide.
And our mission. Clean.
Yeah. Our Geno Clean was.
Yeah. You know, the crew that you send to clean a planet immediately after a genocide? That was funny to watch. But it wouldn't have made a good show.
pretty dark.
Very dark.
Yeah, but it's not. You know. I mean, they're monologues, but also they're not inner thoughts, really.
They're like letters. They're like letters. They're all.
Yeah, they're talking. You're talking to someone
because they know they're putting it in the capsule and it's going to be sent. Right, yeah. So they're all kind of imagining. If you were to talk to aliens, what would you say? And these kind of like regular people. Which is all just me, obviously. Just kind of have their own kind of take on it. But they're all addressed to whoever would find the capsule.
It's an address.
It's an address to the aliens.
That I was addressing to a specific person as opposed to Luigi. You were to a potential alien life form. Yeah. That was your address.
The abstract concept of an
life. Everyone was talking to someone, but everyone was talking to someone different. Mm-hmm. So it was not always the concept of the possible aliens or the capsule.
Because you were talking to aliens, but possibly a cosmic intelligence.
Yeah.
It was almost speaking to God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or to the openness that it could be a godlike being, creature. Yeah.
And you don't know if it's a collective mind or a specific one. So you had, I mean, in that part of the show, that's where there was some Darmok in there.
Darmok, and also the caretaker, if anybody loves Voyager.
Yeah, so you were trying to change the, like using pronouns in a way that is unusual in French. Mm-hmm. If I were to translate it now, people will say, well, no, that's what we use in English.
Well, what I did for English for that one, because you saw one of the nights with no subtitles, right?
Yes, no subtitles.
So when we did we did half those show subtitles in English, and that the joke that Luigi does is it mixes single and plural.
They.
Yeah. So what I did in English for that is I mixed a ye olde English, thee, thou, thine, thyself, thine self, and I threw in a couple y'alls in there. So that you kind of have that texture of like, should I say y'all because that's like gender inclusive or art thine or art thou a being? And then if you do it in the same sentence, it's so stupid sounding. I love it.
Because one of the things I enjoyed about that is it wasn't just a thing of gender, which everybody's getting used to now. Yeah. It was also about number.
Are you
a thing of plurality?
In English, it's art thou a singular being? Is y'all a plural entity?
Right.
You know, and then you don't know which register of formality to talk to, but you're just, you know what, I'll just do them both. And then if it's, you know, and it sounds kind of wonky.
And that's the hardest script I've ever had to learn. I can't explain it to English speaking people, but in French, it makes absolutely no sense. And from one sentence to the other, there's no logic that installs itself.
Yeah, sometimes it's thou, sometimes it's y'all.
The character changes it.
And it all the time.
For each sentence, whichever one sounds the funniest in that sentence, but there's no pattern for Luigi to find.
And I was obsessed to get it exactly right, so it was hell to learn.
I got a lot of threatening messages from
an
actor.
How dare you?
He's like, this is the hardest thing I've ever had to learn. You're insane. Also, thank you. I love a challenge.
Yeah. One thing I want to say, Siskoid, is the title of Luigi's piece is Hope. That's the name of his piece. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, Star Trek is kind of hope. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention that, you know, almost in the final analysis here, because it starts with the mission that started. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We get on a note of somewhat of bitterness that mm-hmm. science fiction lied to us. The utopia that we were promised, we're not getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it ends on that hope mm-hmm. that we can reach out to something and mm-hmm. and be accepted.
And humanity is amazing. Mm-hmm. It, mm-hmm. Weird.
In but, weird ways, but yeah,
we're really, amazing. We're a really special kind of creature. You know?
Right. So, through the, and I mean, we get that in smaller moments throughout, whether that's your own character, Philippe André. So even like in your own character, discovering something about themselves and so on. So does it end on, is that the takeaway from the writer? Is it, are we?
I mean, I am always, Marc-André says what I do is bienveillant. Like I have, I want to care for the audience. And I think I don't like things that end in a really dystopian, scary mm-hmm. note. Right? It doesn't make me feel good. So I wanted to kind of leave the audience, after kind of putting them through the ringer, I wanted to leave them with just a little, something a little uplifting at the end without being like falsely optimistic. Mm-hmm. But like, that's why that one's called Hope. Because also humanity's horrifying mm-hmm. and we kind of address that, and there's, you know, there's some video clips that are pretty disturbing to watch in the show. We've kind of edited them in a way that it's not so upsetting mm-hmm. to watch, but I mean we don't not have a clip of 9/11, we don't not have floods in Pakistan this year or mm-hmm. protests in China and like all that stuff, which is
well it's upsetting but then it's quickly followed by something silly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know what, it's exactly our experience.
Yeah, it's meant that way so that nobody's too horrified watching burgers on TV.
But it's basically our experience in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
It's like you see something horrifying, you forget it.
You're
because
like,
there's
oh
a new thing.
Oh my god, who's killing what? Hey, my cat. Yeah. Anyways, hey, Barbie movie. nuclear bombs. So it's exactly what it feels like to me, that kind of like emotional whiplash of like all these things. But leaving people on that feeling, I felt was a little kind of leaving people a little bit like uneasy leaving the theater. Mm-hmm. It's not my personal vibe. I'm trying mm-hmm. to be a little bit more warm with that with people. And then so we wanted to write something optimistic, which was so hard in these last couple of years.
Absolutely.
Remember I had a text that we never used. I was just like, here's everything I hate about people.
Cranky
fans.
And
cranky fans. It's got just a list of the crap that people do. I was annoyed at my roommates from being trapped in my house for 3 years. But yeah, so trying to kind of find, and like humanity's insane, you know, like right now I'm really into bedazzling things. Like people are crafting these really stupid little pieces of glass with little foil backing, and they make this perfect glue, and you glue it on stuff and it looks silly. Humans made that, and also they made bombs. But you know, like it's a little bit of both. So I kind of wanted to touch on all those kind of quirky bits of, you know, like breaking a chicken bone in two and making a wish. Right. You know, like wishing is pretty, I could have done a whole show on like throwing pennies in fountains. Like what kind of species throws pennies into a fountain to make a wish at the mall?
And we put ourselves in the alien skin, you know, as audience. There's the characters telling us things, but there's that video screen, you know, that projection and those sounds. And you're at some point there's, oh yeah, that's right. There's a Klingon version of some song, you know, there's
There's Klingon, and then the Macarena, which I was sitting next to a 9-year-old at one of our shows. I was like, why do you know the dance move to this? Like, that's a global hit. Yeah. Macarena still hits.
All generations. That goes on the record.
So I imagine.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so I imagine you're the alien, and I don't know what our mind is like, but let's say we can understand all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're the audience. It's an information overload.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So it's showing, it's
I
like.
I also would have like uploaded, like just put all of Wikipedia on that record. Yeah.
Right, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Of course, you know, in all languages. And
yeah.
But there's also the idea that we as a species could not, anyways, we could not agree on what to put on the updated buoy anyways. Yeah. So,
absolutely. So just put it all.
Just put it all. And I think the final product of the show that we did is an image of that. It's a mishmash of different monologues. Not everyone is talking to the aliens. Some people are just talking about, he's just talking about his own adventure to find someone else.
Which is totally realistic.
Which is totally realistic.
We could to randomly pick people. Somebody will be talking about Jesus for the full amount of time.
Absolutely.
Send to the alien.
And Flo touches on that in her text. She goes, we couldn't, even if we did do something right, even if we did have contact, there's no way we can all agree on how to manage the situation.
No.
But that's the extreme. But yeah, just sending a new, an updated Voyager, there's no way we can agree on that.
But there's a reference, like, that makes me think of an episode of Parks and Recreation where they're trying to put an updated time capsule for their the town of Pawnee. And then they're all arguing at town hall. He's like, I want to put Twilight in it. She's like, if he's putting Twilight, I'm putting the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then Liz is like, I want to put a picture of my cat. And then they decide at the end that they're going to put in a videotape of them having that discussion is what's going to go in the time capsule, which is the most honest representation of who they are. And I think some of that concept kind of stays in this theater show. I was like, if we could just put a video of us fighting in the rehearsal room about what should be in it, that would, I mean, it would be a terrible show, but it would be kind of an honest representation of who we are trying to figure out what to put in this limited space.
Final thoughts?
Well, you were talking about Roddenberry smoking weed earlier.
I don't know that he did. He's an ex-cop. I don't know about that. Okay. But
well, I just recently bought some weed that was called Romulan. So I thought I'd have to put that in.
They're associated with green. Green is their color.
Yeah. See, I didn't touch on Romulans in the show because they're too scary.
No. Well, I sent a picture of when I bought it. I sent you a picture. But it was indica, and I thought it was weird that they would choose to have indica for Romulan because Romulans are badasses, no? Yeah. Really big badasses?
Yeah, but they probably need to relax. They look pretty stressed. They're always plotting something. All their equipment's really... It looks stressful.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody's serious. You screw up, they're going to, you know...
That's probably just a joke about the color.
Yeah.
I would say. And it's a cool name.
Yeah. The name is cool.
That was your conclusion.
That was my conclusion.
fits the character you were playing.
I love it. Doing a show about space was fun.
Yeah, doing a show about space was fun, and to, like you said earlier, to finish on a positive, uplifting note with the show, when we could have...
Uplifting?
Well...
Melancholy.
Melancholy, but not a... it was a downer, in a way, because I was bawling my eyes out every night, but I think it was still a positive note about... it was filling in an emotional way to dream of not being alone, and to dream of having contact with aliens in a positive way, and that maybe they would be amazed at what we are and not repulsed. We could have easily gone in a very negative way or in a very dystopian way or
cynical,
in a very
cynical.
They're gonna hate us, we're all disgusting, goodbye aliens,
we'll all be blown up long before
we'll all be dead, bye bye, lights out. We could have done that, but no, we decided, you decided mostly to Celeste,
hello,
keep it to keep it light in a way.
Because remember when at first, maybe that was not going to be the final piece of the show?
No.
So that kind of changed. So for a while it was L'amour c'est grave, which was another text that we were kind of finishing the show with.
Yeah.
But it was too much of a downer.
That was supposed to finish with the first text read again.
In coming back. And then, And then when it was decided to finish with hope, to me, it made that, when we decided to put the camera down, the live camera down, and when hope came to as kind of the bookend, like to really wrap things up, to me, that's when the show really came.
Yeah.
When it gelled together.
And that music. Catherine. Catherine.
The girl with the fake legs.
The girl with the fake legs.
Real guitar, fake legs.
She plays a mean guitar.
The song she sang was The Craters of the Moon.
Yeah, she wrote it for the show.
Beautiful.
Well, on that note, literally, thanks again, Céleste Godin, Luigi Beaulieu, Philippe-André Colette.
Yeah.
Are you guys working on another project already, or is it too soon to ask?
I mean, I'm working on another project that's not theater. It has nothing to do with anything we talk about.
I'm working on sleeping.
Yeah.
I love it.
You try some Romulan. I heard it works pretty good.
Apparently. Get me some of that.
I'm working on some kind of alchemist play.
Where you're an alchemist?
Yeah.
That's the vaguest thing I've ever heard in my life.
But it seems to me like the third time I know that you've played a mad scientist type, because...
just got crazy eyes.
I mean, this show counts where when you're launching the ship, everybody's a scientist. And then there was that TV show that we were all a part of.
Telex.
Shippo.
Yeah.
Where you played a mad scientist.
Available on YouTube.
Lunatic.
Yeah.
Played Telex Leblanc.
So that's at least four. Yeah. You sank the city. as I remember. So I played a mutant in that.
Oh, yeah.
So
classic casting.
Yeah. So maybe that's just it's your type, mad scientist. I think more and more.
As I grow older.
As you grow older, I think you're more and more that type.
The hair.
That's because you really go for it. And you really go full on with feeling. If you're a mad scientist, you're going to be a complete mad scientist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's why you would get cast as that, because you're going to go all the way for it.
Full performance.
Yeah.
All right. I will release you back into the cosmos. And I'll stick around for subspace transmissions. That's your feedback on our previous episode.
Oh. Saturn, who's there? Hyperion to a Saturn.
Follow Siskoid's deep scene-by-scene dive into adaptations of Shakespeare's Hamlet on Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Network's Hamlet podcast. To listen or not to listen isn't the question. Kenneth Branagh, Derek Jacobi, Mel Gibson, Laurence Olivier, Ethan Hawke, David Tennant, Classics Illustrated, and many more covered every episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com or where you usually get your podcasts.
Is silence.
Incoming Subspace Transmissions, a selection of your feedback on our previous episode in which Corey Musa and I discussed recasting in Star Trek. Well, let's start with Chris Franklin. Says, great discussion, guys. I thought Paul Wesley did okay as Kirk. He was a bit slim looking, but I thought he brought a bit of that reserved bookish Kirk from the first few episodes of TOS Season 1, and if Kirk wasn't in command of the Enterprise, maybe the swagger was indeed missing, although he did have Kirk's reliance on bluffs going well for him. I'm sorry if a director's insistence hampered Wesley's first shot at the character, because I know my opinion is probably in the minority. I get what you mean about Ethan Peck's enunciations. He does seem to have a bit of a minor mumble or lisp, maybe. Nothing against the actor, but on top of his precise wording, Nimoy had that voice. Quinto doesn't have it either, and I think part of it is neither actor probably smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, as Nimoy apparently did. Truth be told, and no offense to Corey, but while I like Quinto as Spock, I never bought him in the role as much as I did Pine as Kirk. And since Kirk is still my favorite Trek character, that's saying something. I know Nimoy gave Quinto the Vulcan salute of approval, so what do I know? I think maybe it's the rather emotional direction they took Spock in that somewhat hurts me, connecting one iteration of the character to another. I think the T'Pring angle and the attraction to Chapel are better ways to go to explore Spock's romantic feelings. Speaking of Chapel, it's hard to not like this new version of the character better. TOS Chapel's only real chance to shine outside of pining for Spock was in What Are Little Girls Made Of, and that fiancé bot was never mentioned again. Kind of makes you wonder how this Chapel ended up engaged to that guy to begin with. Maybe something we'll see down the road in Strange New Worlds? And yes, yes, yes to you, Siskoid, and what you said about Pine's Kirk in Beyond. I think that movie did a wonderful job of merging the two iterations together. You can almost forget the asinine way Pine Kirk got command of the Enterprise. It's easier than in the Mirror Universe when you just have to assassinate your superior officer. I still like Trek 09 despite this. Into Darkness, well, even Corey doesn't like it, and he was in it. Alan W. Wright has a follow-up comment, says, listening to the podcast now and really enjoying it, I like Jess Bush's Chapel so much that I'm willing to say the TOS Chapel is merely one of Corby's androids, and the real Chapel is roaming the universe, living her best life, and getting into hijinks with Ortegas. But that said, I read some of Strange New Worlds continuity into TOS scenes. Now Chapel's look in Amok Time isn't who is she, but her again? I thought we were done with this crap years ago. Her have you ever been engaged rhetorical question in What Are Little Girls Made Of is actually a more pointed, don't give me that, you were engaged in a long-distance relationship, you know how these things work. So sarcasm, right, Alan? Okay, cool. Chris Franklin comes back because he forgot to comment on Anson Mount's Pike. Well, it goes without saying he's great. A wonderful lead and an inspiring character with just enough flaws to make his charm that much more endearing. Is he a bit more Kirk-like than Hunter's Pike? Yes. It's often been theorized that Star Trek would never have worked and had the longevity it did with Hunter's Brooding Pike. Yes, I think Gene Hendricks and I talked about that in the very first episode of this podcast. Chris goes on. It says, was Pike going to lighten up post-Cage? Maybe, maybe not. But if he hadn't, and Shatner's natural charisma and charm wasn't there, would anyone care about Trek today? Even Nimoy said he didn't know what to do with Spock with such an intense captain in Pike. Interesting things to ponder. But it's no wonder Mount's Pike is more Kirkish, despite the Sword of Damocles hanging over his head. The series just wouldn't be as fun otherwise. Does this hamper Paul Wesley's ability to play Kirk? At least a bit. Possibly. He doesn't want to look like he's mimicking Mount, who's channeling a bit of Shatner's Kirk. The writers seemed like they were going to lean into the hoary trope about Kirk, that he was somewhat trigger-happy and bloodthirsty. Well, sure, compared to Picard, maybe he is, but it was a much wilder frontier in Kirk's time. I'm glad they pulled back and showed that Kirk's pushing for aggression when needed was ultimately justified. David S. Gutierrez says, great discussion, but wasn't the Pike recasting the first recasting? I don't know who replaced Jeffrey Hunter, but he beeped like nobody's business. That's right. There was an actor in the chair that wasn't Jeffrey Hunter, but a limited performance. Paul Keane says, really enjoyed the episode. Finally listened today. I think you're right that we're going to see more recasting in the future, but I had not considered recasting TNG crew. But after watching Sir Patrick look really old on Picard, it probably is time if we want to see these characters again. I would rather see a Titan series instead of a Stargazer series. I thought the Titan books had a cool concept that it was the most diverse ship in the Starfleet from the perspective of having more races on it than any other ship. Now it would get expensive to have some of the races, like the water-breathing ones, etc., but you could do a lot with that concept. Anyway, thanks for the great episode. And of course, since he left this comment, Paul, you must have seen the Titan is part of the Picard show, but of course it's a later iteration of the Titan, and it doesn't have that crew, obviously. But you did make me want to check out the Titan books, and I've read two of them so far, and I agree, it's an interesting concept. Two books in, you're just in the introduction. It feels like they haven't gone on that mission yet, and the writers are paying off things from earlier books that they've written, so... You know, I haven't gotten out of the pilot, so to speak. So I can't wait to see what happens next in that series of books, because I'm going to keep reading. The Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. It even unlocks rewards. For example, for $5 a month, you could get yourself on the Starfleet commendations list, like the giant bird of the galaxy, Doug Van Diver. Join Doug and I in the fleet at patreon.com. And as usual, let me remind you that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on the Fire and Water Facebook page or Twitter, where we are FW Podcast. Although those two social media probably won't be read on the air because they're kind of hard to track down a month or more later. So until the next episode, this is Siskoid reminding you to go boldly.